today on The Novelizers. Talk show royalty, Dick Cavett. From Seinfeld, Fred Stoller. Plus Joe Randazzo and intern Kevin Carter. Now here's your host, Andy Richter.
Where do great ideas come from? Well, the ancient Greeks believed that all inspiration flowed from a bunch of goddesses known as the Muses. According to Norse mythology, the blood of the wise Kvasir could provide artistic insight to anyone who drank it. Modern science tells us both these theories are total bullshit, and yet we're no closer to discovering a surefire way of generating great art with virtually no effort than Aristotle was centuries ago. Until now. Because I, Andy Richter, have just hit upon a virtual geyser of great new literature, and baby, this spring ain't never running dry. How? I just take stories nobody's using anyway, the ones in old movies, and then I turn them into brand new books by chopping them up into scenes and then having those scenes novelized by today's best authors. Finally, I get great actors like Brad Pitt and Natalie Portman, only not as expensive as them, to narrate those chapters into a podcast. Intrigued? Well, I'm about to blow your mind, because you're listening to that exact podcast right now. I call it The Novelizers. This season on The Novelizers, we're tackling a film that was set in outer space but filmed right here on Earth, just like the moon landing. I'm talking about Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. And here to catch us up on the story so far is everybody's favorite intern, Kevin. Kevin, please tell our audience and any hosts who may have fallen asleep last time what's going on in our story.
So, Khan's this genetically enhanced supervillain who wants revenge on Kirk for stranding him on a really boring planet. He's also after the Secret Genesis Project, which was made by one of Kirk's ex-girlfriends. There's this big space battle, and Khan's ship is all trashed, but so is Kirk's.
Thanks, Kev. Today's first chapter was written by Dennis DiClaudio and narrated by TV legend Dick Cavett. Mr. Cavett, engage.
Ain't nothing regular about any of this. This is chapter 11. Novelized by Dennis DiClaudio. Narrated by Dick Cavett. William Shatner hated going to the Enterprise's sick bay. Hated it. And not because it meant he had to look at sick people, it was because of what his presence entailed. To catch an up-close glimpse of a Starfleet captain, an admiral no less, was an extremely exciting experience. And a lot of these boys didn't have all that much excitement left in them. They lay burned, blasted, and befuddled, teetering on the brink of death, writhing in agony on their medical slabs, draped stupefied atop whatever surface could bear them. The star nurses had one kid covered in some sort of tinfoil blanket. Microwave poisoning, no doubt. Inside the operating theater, Shatner found Dr. Bones irradiating young Preston's blastoid wounds with a bioflash wand. And at the Admiral's approach, Preston inched up from his deathbed to cough out a meager question of his commander. Is the word given? Shatner looked back with magnanimous poise. He would humor the dying boy. The word is given, he whispered. Warp speed. Aye. The boy wheezed before warping off on his own adventures through the nether cosmos. Dr. Bones somberly pulled a tinfoil blanket over the boy's face, and Shatner made a mental note to ask why not just regular cloth ones, but later. Space Station Regular One, this is Starship Enterprise, please come in. Uhura turned away from the comms panel. No response, sir. Shatner snapped his fingers, prowling the bridge like a sleek, contemplative cat. Sensors, Captain? Scanners and sensors still inoperative, Spock returned, his voice thick with emotionlessness. There's no way to tell what's inside the station. and no way of knowing if Reliant is still in the area, Chatner thought out loud in Spock's direction. What do you make of the planetoid beyond? Regula is Class D. It consists of various remarkable ores, essentially a great rock in space. Ah, a great rock indeed. And what are rocks truly great for? Reliant could be hiding behind that rock. A distinct possibility, Spock confirmed. Mr. Scott, do you have enough power for transporters? Shatner barked into the intercom. I'm going down to the station. He turned his attention to Dr. Bones. Can you spare someone? There may be people hurt. Yeah, Dr. Bones replied. I can spare me. He didn't know a karate chop from a Romulan knuckle jab, but Shatner knew better than to try to talk his longtime compatriot out of coming. Begging the Admiral's pardon, Mr. Sovik objected in her bloodless Vulcan inflection. General Order 15, : no flag officer shall beam into a hazardous area without armed escort. Shatner quickly ran through the general orders in his head. 12, 13, 14, 16. There's no such regulation, he said. The look on Mr. Savick's face said it all. Learning to lie like a decent human. Good for her. Shatner hadn't beamed in a while. You don't get to beam all that much behind a Starfleet desk. He strode along with Dr. Bones and Mr. Sovik onto the transporting platform with golden Tyrian butterflies in his stomach. You never know what you're going to find on the other side of a beam. Once in place, the Admiral nodded toward the technician, who immediately began to fiddle with the knobs. Shatner felt uneasy, though, like he was forgetting something. But what? Then came the familiar tingle of his particles accelerating to beam velocity, the unearthly glow of the molecular imaging scanner cataloging his every atom. He'd be vanishing any second. What was he forgetting? His collar. Anyone or anything could be waiting on the end of this beam. He reached back over his shoulders, snapped his collar up into its more fashionable position, just in time to disappear. They reappeared inside Regula One. There was nobody waiting for them. Shatner kept the collar up just in case. Mr. Sovik looked down to her tricorder. Indeterminate life signs, she reported. The tricorder beeped suspiciously. Phasers on stun, Shatner ordered. The space station was eerie, like a ghost space station. But Shatner had a feeling that the ghosts here just might be alive. He looked down a corridor and found nothing. He continued his search while Mr. Sovik's tricorder went on beeping in the background. He still did not understand why it had to make that noise. And he was not going to ask Spock again. Elsewhere on the Regula, Mr. Sovik strolled with eyes wide open while Dr. Bones jittered toward a door. A noise! Dr. Bones nearly soiled his regulation shorts, but it turned out to just be a space rat. He stepped back backwards away from the road, being careful to keep it in his sight in case it decided to attack. He felt something on his back. Another space rat? Dr. Bones spun around and came face to face with death. Not death, exactly, but a dead man, bloodied and dangling from the ceiling like a side of Abronian beef. Shatner, he cried, ... They were all dead, which meant the collar could come down. The bodies, all five of them, had been hung by their legs from a high thermonic pipe and left to dangle. Wasn't it just like Khan to temper his savage brutality with a bit of flair? Well, rigor hasn't set in. A now more composed and less hysterical Dr. Bones reported as Shatner lowered another corpse. This couldn't have happened too long ago, Shatner. But Shatner wasn't thinking about time. He was thinking about a lady from his past, one that he had seen naked. Carol, he whispered to himself. Mr. Savick's tricorder started beeping madly at a thermowave locker. She'd found something. Shatner delivered a killer 2-inch punch to the glass case protecting the locker's open button. The side door slid open, revealing his old navigator, Pavel Chekhov, folded over and jammed in, but still alive. Beside him sat Clark Terrell, captain of the USS Reliant. "Oh, sir," Chekhov said, his voice dripping with remorse. "It was Khan. We found him on Sadie Alpha 5. He put creatures in our bodies to control our minds, made us say lies, do things. But we beat him," the Russian said with pride. "He thought he controlled us, but he was wrong. We beat him." Captain Terrell was strong. Shatner turned to Terrell, who was staring off into the middle distance. The middle of what? He had no idea. "Captain, where's Dr. Marcus? Where are the Genesis materials?" "He couldn't find them," Terrell responded flatly. "Even the data banks were empty." "Erased?" Shatner asked. But Terrell was not interested in that just now. He tortured those people. None of them would tell him anything. He went wild. He slit their throats. He wanted to tear the place apart. But he was late. He had to get back to the Reliant in time to blow you to bits. The ship's crew had been left marooned on Sadie Alpha 5, Terrell revealed. "He's completely mad, Admiral. He blames you for the death of his wife." "I know what he blames me for," Shatner shot back. "The escape pods were all in place, which probably meant they didn't get away in escape pods. Where's the transporter room?" "The unit's been left on," Shatner said, staring elk-like at the transporter room control panel, "which means nobody remained to turn it off. Those people back there bought escape time for Genesis with their lives," Dr. Bones said. Though Shatner would have had the same thought had he been given a few more seconds. "This is not logical," Mr. Savick declared. "These coordinates are deep inside Regula, a planetoid we know to be lifeless." Shatner sat down in the technician's chair to have a good think. He flipped open his communicator. "Shatner to Enterprise. Spock here," Spock replied. "Captain Spock, damage report," Shatner demanded. "The situation is grave, Admiral. We won't have main power for 6 days. Auxiliary power has temporarily failed, and restoration may be possible in 2 days by the book, Admiral." Nearby on the Reliant, other ears were listening in on the transmission, ears that belonged to a certain Khan Noonien Singh. "Meaning you can't even beam us back?" Shatner asked of Spock, though he knew the answer. "Not at present," Spock said. And on the Reliant, eyes turned down in thought. Eyes that also belonged to a certain Khan Noonien Singh. "Captain Spock," Shatner spoke across the transom, "if you don't hear from us within 1 hour, your orders are to restore what power you can, take the Enterprise to the nearest starbase, and alert Starfleet Command as soon as you're out of jamming range." Uhura broke in. "Sir, we won't leave you behind." "Uhura, if you don't hear from us, there won't be anybody behind." Because they'd be dead. Shatner took for granted they didn't need to say that part. Captain Terrell spoke up. "It's all the same, Admiral. We'd like to share the risk." "Right. Let's go." "Go?" Dr. Bones asked. "Where are we going?" "Where they went," Shatner answered. "Suppose they went nowhere," Dr. Bones offered cowardfully. Shatner thought for a second before responding. "Then this will be your big chance to get away from it all." Shatner was pleased with that witticism. So pleased, in fact, that he completely neglected to pop his collar before the five of them beamed down.
Fascinating stuff. And now, my intern Kevin Carter shall interview one of the fine folks who made the actual film Wrath of Khan. Or so I'm told. Kevin?
Hello. Today I'm here with Joe Randazzo, who is DeForest Kelley's executive assistant on Wrath of Khan 2. This is very special to me because I feel like I have a teammate. You know, I feel like I have somebody who knows my life and my what I go through. So how's it going, Joe?
Oh, it's going very well. Who are you referring to? Who knows your life and what you're going through?
I was thinking you. You know, so because you're an intern and I'm an intern as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. It seems, yeah, maybe there was a miss. I was Mr. Kelley's executive assistant.
Okay, so you did things for Mr. Kelley?
Executive, in an executive sense, an executive.
Oh, so you wore like a suit and tie when you did it.
I often did wear a suit and tie or a cravat. And it was a paid position.
Oh.
So it was a salaried position, which I don't believe interns generally are.
Well, he pays me in smiles, and he also pays me in a lot of IOUs. I have like a scrapbook full of IOUs that Andy said I'll get one day. So I look at those as like promises, you know, and so that's a payment, right?
Well, it's good experience at any rate.
How did you get into being Mr. Kelley's intern? I mean, I'm sorry, executive assistant.
Yeah, thank you. It's a funny story. I had always been a fan of DeForest Kelley's since his work with Ann Doran in Fear in the Night, a 1947 film noir crime film, which was directed by Maxwell Shane, starring, of course, Paul Kelly and DeForest Kelley. Unrelated. And I had always wanted to be an assistant of some kind. I would hang around the studio every evening. This was in 1947. Waiting around for Mr. Kelley to emerge. I learned his habits. I learned his dietary restrictions. I learned his route home. There was just something magnetic about him, about his performances, about the way he carried himself, about the way he drank his coffee. And one evening, he pulled over quite suddenly on La Brea Boulevard, which is one of the great streets of Hollywood, California. Got out of his car and approached my car in a pretty aggressive way, and asked why I had been following him around. And I froze. You know, you hear of a fight or flight. I froze. He berated me for a good 20, 25 minutes till a police officer came and asked if everything was okay. And I then was when I started to fight. I fought him. I fought the police officer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. At that point. Yeah. It was a knock 'em down Donnybrook sort of a brawl in the streets. Mm-hmm. He and I wound up spending the night in jail in a little cantina jail off of Hollywood Boulevard. Along with, as well, the late great Grace Kelley was in jail that evening.
Oh, wow. That just seems like a very, very important jail cell, you know?
Well, a lot of people don't know this, but in the 40s and 50s, the thing to do in Hollywood was to commit crime. Petty larceny, petty theft, littering, loitering. And we all met in that jail cell. We became fast friends. I pitched them some of my movie ideas, which they did not like. And later on, later that morning when DeForest and I, Mr. Kelley and I, were walking back to our cars with our blazers slung over our shoulders in that rakish posture that you see so many so often from the people of that time, he let me know that he was looking for an assistant and that if I was good enough, I would work my way up to executive assistant.
When Mr. Kelley got the role for Bones, for the movie, did he say anything to you about it? Did he seem excited or anything like that for the role?
No, he was not excited at all.
Oh.
Don't forget, he had been playing Bones for years on Star Trek already. Three seasons, I believe, the show ran.
Mm.
And he hated every moment of it.
Really?
He could never get over the fact that he was not an actual doctor and was being expected to play one. And to him, to Mr. Kelley, acting is all about realism. And he went to medical school. He tried to become a doctor. He demanded that they pay for him to go to medical school so that he could become a doctor and more mm-hmm. accurately portray mm-hmm. A doctor in the program. And during that time, the production fell apart and was never renewed. But he did get his degree in pediatric oncology.
Did he ever like pay, you know what I'm saying, for you to get better education or more education or anything like that to better yourself as well as his executive assistant?
Well, his belief was as he became more educated, one's executive assistant should become less educated. So I had to go through a sort of rigorous dumbing down process where I would go and live in the slums of London. And it was a fun process for me along the way. I learned to play craps. I learned pickpocketing, sort of a reverse Pygmalion.
Okay.
He very much appreciated it. And he would tip me 2 pence every other week and a fresh bite of mutton.
Well, I mean, yeah. And plus, you got to go to London.
I did get to go to London. I was stowed away on a kerosene ship. It was a 3-month voyage, and I was mutilated and assaulted multiple times on the voyage. But I knew that it was for a good cause.
Let's talk about growing up. Mm. You know, before I ask the question, just let you know that my parents absolutely despise the fact that I'm an intern for Andy Richter. Not even the intern, just the fact that I'm an intern for Andy Richter. They don't like it. Yeah. But how did your parents, your family take it when they realized that you were just going to be, you know, an executive assistant for the rest of your life?
Well, my parents were both dirt poor. You know, one of them was a sponge wringer on the Titanic, and the other was an assistant sponge wringer on the Lusitania. So for them, any job that received an income was considered of great wealth. They were extremely proud of me. They were enamored of Hollywood. They were enamored of automobiles. The fact that I was able to drive an automobile in Hollywood to them was the greatest dream.
Okay. Yeah. DeForest Kelly seems like a guy that needs a lot of things. Like, you know, needs a lot of assistance and stuff, which is, of course, why you're there. Was there anything like on the set of Wrath of Khan that you had to do? You know what I'm saying? Like, far as like, as his executive assistant and he's acting and everything like that, what things did you have to do behind the scenes for him?
Yes, well, he did not like to speak to many of the members of the cast. So I would walk just to his right throughout, you know, the entirety of the shoot. And if a cast member approached, I would be carrying a large wedding cake. And if any members of the cast approached, I would trip in a sort of whimsical way between them, crashing the wedding cake to the ground, and thus providing a means of escape for Mr. Kelly.
Was there any behind the scenes drama or anything behind the scenes you was able to see that most people wouldn't be able to know what's going on? We've heard so much so far in these other interviews. Is there anything that you've witnessed on set?
Are there any examples of the kinds of things that people talk about? I don't normally gossip. I consider that the devil's poem, the devil's poetry.
Yeah, we've heard about William Shatner's hatred for slugs. Yeah, so we've had a lot of talks about what happened behind the scenes.
Well, one thing I can tell you about that you may not know about was that there was day 6 or 7 of shooting very early on. A production assistant, which we call a PA in the business. Nobody knew who this gaunt, fey production assistant was. Hollow-eyed, high cheekbone, prominent bone structure in their face, and they wore a long black robe. They brought coffee to the major cast members and then stopped in the middle of the day to make an announcement that there would be a Wrath of Khan curse, that none of them would escape, and that each, one by one, would fall victim to this curse. Now a chill went over the cast, and they were immediately ordered out, to get some creamer. And one by one, the curse has claimed its victims. If you look at that original cast list, mm-hmm. there are so few that remain. In fact, I believe only Mr. Takei and Mr. Koenig are left alive. And they live every day in terrible fear for the moment when the curse will claim them.
All right, right. Thank you for joining us, everybody, for this interview portion of the Novelizers. This was Joe. I have been Kevin Carter. Please enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Love it. Today's next chapter was novelized by River Clegg, who has written for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and narrated by Seinfeld's Fred Stoller. Fred, make it so.
Chapter 12, Kirk with Eels, novelized by River Clegg, read by Fred Stoller. That's me. Kirk's life flashed before his eyes, not because he was about to die, but because he liked thinking about all the stuff that happened to him since he was born. His first kiss, his first beer, his first time listening to Pet Sounds all the way through, and then wondering if there was something he was missing, or maybe you need a really fancy sound system for it to make sense. "Beg pardon, sir?" one of the spaceship guys asked Kirk. "What? Did I say something?" Kirk replied, annoyed that he had forgotten the spaceship guy's name. "Frank? You were saying something about how Wouldn't It Be Nice is a great song, but the rest of the album is just kind of meh. But you were muttering it under your breath pretty angrily, as though it's a topic that's eating away at you from within." "Well, it's not. Listen up. We've just beamed down to this moon with our space team to do Star Trek stuff, and that's exactly what we're going to do." "Aye, sir." The moon's surface was dusty and craterous, like the skin of a mummy who'd been mummified by someone who was just learning how to do it. And the interior of the moon base, which is where they had all beamed to, looked like a futuristic Aspen ski lodge. Plus, everyone's outfits had these wide, woolly-looking collars. They looked like fancy winter coats you'd wear while on a sci-fi skiing trip. "Hey, where's the chairlift?" one of them said, and everyone burst out laughing. It was the perfect joke because they all immediately understood that, yes, the whole aesthetic did resemble some sort of ski lodge, and it wasn't just one observer's weird interpretation that no one else would have understood or agreed with. "Ha ha ha ha!" Everyone was still laughing. "It wasn't that funny," Kirk yelled. They all knew that Kirk tended to think of himself as the funny one, and he always got insecure whenever anyone else cracked a joke. They felt bad for Kirk. "Hey, look at that silver thing," Kirk said, and sure enough, there was a big silver thing. Kirk and Frank? Ronald? Ugh, this was going to drive Kirk crazy. Walked over to it, and Ronald said, "Genesis, I presume," which was very exciting because Genesis was an important Star Trek thing that could use technology to make dead planets habitable or whatever. It was called Genesis as a tribute to the Bible and its author, Steve Genesis. "Oh no, a guy is coming to attack you," someone on the team yelled to Kirk. All right, long story short, the guy attacking Kirk was David, Kirk's son, whom he'd had with a woman named Dr. Carol Marcus, who also showed up in the room right then. Somehow, they all figured out who was who and shared a laugh. "Sorry for trying to attack you with a space knife, Dad," David said, visibly embarrassed. "It's all right, son. I'm sorry. I never supported you or your Beach Boys cover band." It was, Kirk smiled, but he was also gritting his teeth like what he was about to say pained him. "It was good. Thanks, Dad." David hugged Kirk. "I'm glad I had sex with you, Kirk, and that I gave birth to you 9 months after, David," Carol said. But trouble was brewing. Two guys whose brains were being controlled by, get this, Eel Laver suddenly appeared. It was Chekhov and Terrell, who were supposed to be on Kirk's side, only they weren't on account of the eel larva. They were pointing their laser guns at Kirk. Seriously? My kid just tried to kill me, and now you? Yes, Terrell said. Then he spoke into his radio. That's what you want, right, boss? That better not be Khan you're talking to, Kirk yelled. It probably is, said the guy whose name Kirk was pretty sure was Ronald or Tony. Yes, yes, definitely Tony. And it was Khan. His skin was green and sickly, and he had some sort of space IV drip on his wrist that kind of resembled a handcuff. He looked like the last surviving Motley Crue roadie. Yes, Terrell, I want to kill Kirk, Khan said into the radio. But first kill someone who's not terribly important so you can show off how your space gun vaporizes people's entire bodies without leaving a corpse. Good idea. Then Terrell did that. Awesome, Khan said. Now, do that same thing to Kirk. But I don't want to. Kirk is my friend. Listen to the eel controlling your brain, Khan barked. Eels are the most notable and godly of creatures. They need no appendages to propel themselves forth. They glide, magnificent, bestowing upon an undeserving world a glimpse of physical perfection as they dart about in their glistening forms of purest light. Do as the eel says. Again with the eels, Terrell said. I'd rather die than hear more of this. So he shot himself. All right, Chekhov, can you please murder Kirk, Khan said, exasperated. But Chekhov also wouldn't do it. Instead, he collapsed to the ground, either because he couldn't bring himself to kill his ally, or because he suffered an aneurysm at that exact moment, which would have been a pretty wild coincidence, but still, it's not impossible. Okay, the eel crawled out of Chekhov's ear. Watch out for that eel, Kirk shouted and shot the eel. It was gross. Then Kirk picked up the radio. Hey, Khan? Is this Kirk? You know damn well that it's Kirk. The two guys whose brains had eels in them are dead, and they didn't kill me. I know, Khan sighed. Talk about a disappointment. I can relate. The other day I bought some bananas, but they all went bad before I ate them. This is nothing like that. Well, they're both disappointments. Let's cut to the chase, Khan said. You may be alive, but that's actually better for me because I'm going to strand you on this moon base, much the way you stranded me all those years ago. Also, I'm going to beam that Genesis thing up to my ship because I think it will be fun to use. But back to you. I'm going to maroon you on this base because in theory, you'll be so unhappy here that you'll actually wish I had killed you. The boredom will be unbearable, especially because this version of the future doesn't have smartphones. You might also run out of food and resort to cannibalism. In any case, you'll never escape this place. You'll be buried alive. The ultimate punishment. This is my masterpiece, my growing achievement, my pet sounds. Not pet sounds again, Kirk said, rolling his eyes. What, you don't like pet sounds? Khan sounded aggrieved. I don't hate it, but people are always like, oh, pet sounds is so great. It's the best album to come out of the 60s, blah, blah, blah. Come on! It's just a bunch of high-pitched harmonies by guys who forgot that their job was to sing about surfboards. Fuck you, Dad, David yelled. You never believed in my Beach Boys cover band. Wait, wait, wait. You were in a Beach Boys cover band? Khan interjected with genuine excitement. At least someone knows good music, David said. Taste is subjective, replied Khan. But yes, I think Brian Wilson was a genius. More importantly, I think any good father should nurture his child's passions, even if he doesn't happen to share them. Thank you, Khan. Well, said Kirk defensively, it's not like I never nurtured. David, tell me, Khan went on, does it get any better than the harpsichord on You Still Believe in Me? Right, harpsichon, said Kirk caustically. Nothing says musical triumph like haunted Victorian carnival noise. Listen, I'm just going to say I hate pet sounds. Not because it's bad, but because people like you won't shut up about it, honestly. It almost makes me hate the Beach Boys, period. And they did some great stuff. Good Vibrations, Kokomo, those were killer. But then people like you come along and put them on this ridiculous pedestal because of Pet Sounds, when in reality, it's a fine album that's still miles worse than fucking Magical Mystery Tour. Someone gasped. Everyone was staring at Kirk. I mean, Kirk stammered, sensing that he'd gone too far. It's got All You Need Is Love on it. Anyway, I'm going to strand you on this moon base now, Khan said. Good talk. Okay, maybe it's not that much worse than Magical Mystery Tour, but come on, you got to admit that it's still not in the same league as Sgt. Pepper. I know people have started to turn against that album a little bit, and maybe it's been slightly overrated. Obviously, it's no Revolver, but with a little help from my friends, it's a truly great showcase for Ringo. And look, everybody, I was just joking about Pat Sounds. After all, I'm the funny one in the group, right? Right? Just stop. The guy whose name Kirk thought was Frank, then Ronald, then Tony said, "No, Con, I have good musical opinions. I used to have a Rolling Stone subscription. I know the name of Jimi Hendrix's drummer, Mitch something. Con, Con, Con."
Thank you, Fred. Well, that's all the novelization I have for you today. Thanks for listening. Kevin, will you land this spaceship?
Will do, Andy. Thanks to this week's contributors, Dick Cavett, Fred Stoller, River Clegg, Dennis DiClaudio,
and Joe Randazzo.
Links to their fabulous books, swag, and cameo accounts can be all found in the show description. The Novelizers was created by Stephen Levinson, produced by Stephen, Chris Karwowski, and Rob Kuttner, and edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Karwowski. Music by Cole Imhoff, Andrew Lynn, Mike Wilson, and Chris Messick. Special thanks to Sarah Mabe, Crystal Dennis, Dennis DiClaudio, and Hannah Levinson. Follow The Novelizers on Instagram and Twitter at The Novelizers, or visit thenovelizers.com. The Novelizers is a work of parody, unauthorized by Paramount, Roddenberry Entertainment, or Star Trek. I'm Andy's intern, Kevin Carter. Good night.